Hey, everybody. It is Tuesday, March 19th. You're listening to the Mo News Podcast, one of a few podcasts we have here at Mo News. I'm Moshe Wanunu.
And I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts.
And we read all the news and read between the lines so you don't have to. And starting today, we bring you an additional podcast.
Mo News, The Interview. It's where we're going to have interviews and deep dives into the biggest and most interesting headlines with some of the smartest people in the world, dare we say.
Yeah, in our opinion, in our humble opinion. Obviously, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, we bring you interspersed interviews with authors, political leaders, business leaders, a variety of topics, parenting experts. And we've decided at this point, since we're giving you the daily fill Monday through Friday here on this pod, to launch the second pod, Mo News, The Interview, where we will continue to bring you those deep dives and interviews, a separate podcast. So some of you will want all of the above. Some of you just want your daily fix. Some of you just want the deep dives into various subjects. So we're offering you quite a buffet here at Mo News. So we're very excited to launch Mo News, The Interview. We're trying to make it very easy to find in your feed. So this pod is the blue logo. The Interview is the black logo. And for those of you familiar with the premium podcast, that will now be the white logo.
Moshe, a poo-poo platter of podcasts.
Say that three times faster, Jill.
It's our new tagline.
So make sure to favorite and like Mo News, The Interview, available at least in your Apple and Spotify feeds today, and it'll eventually get onto all the feeds within the next 24 hours.
Okay, the other big piece of news is that...
bigger than our new podcast, Jill?
Well, some royal news. Perhaps not bigger in our world. However, there is high interest. Apparently, Princess Kate has been spotted out and about for the first time since her abdominal surgery. So she was allegedly seen visiting a farmer's market with Will. And there is video.
Yes.
Obviously, people are a little bit skeptical because of the debacle with that Mother's Day picture.
The PR mess that they've made for themselves. But yes, the story came out over the weekend saying she visited a farmer's market. She was looking healthy and happy, but there were no pictures. Many of you wrote, well, if there's no pics, it didn't happen. And then suddenly, midday on Monday, video, a few seconds of video of her carrying bags alongside Will at said farmer's market has been released. I imagine, Jill, this will tamp down to a certain extent the rumor mill, which has been going berserk, especially in the aftermath of the failure of a photo rollout there.
Unless they learned nothing and this is not a real video, then that will just make everything a lot worse.
I can't even. I'm sure a lot of the by the time you're listening to this in the morning, a number of people who will have done AI analysis to make sure that is in fact Kate. I'm sure rumors will be like, it's a lookalike, it's this. I think, you know, ideally this puts this to bed before she makes official public appearances in the future. But, you know, I think there was only a certain level of interest going into the photo. The photo was released, which got a whole bunch of the rest of us intrigued, being
what
like,
a disaster.
What is happening? We were going to give her till Easter, but then, which is when they said she would be out again. Anyway, bottom line is there is footage. We'll see what the analysis of the tape looks like. But I think most of us can move on, though there will be a group of people who, you know, will continue to enjoy the various theories out there.
Let's go to the videotape.
Yes.
What's that reference? Do you know?
America's Funniest Home Videos. Wait, no. I think Bob Saget used to say something similar. Jill, which one are you going with?
Warner Wolf. Didn't he used to say that when he would go to the sports highlights?
That's a local news reference for New York?
Oh, I guess so. I guess it was okay.
I grew up in Chicago. So if you're a local New Yorker and you grew up with Warner Wolf, then you would have gotten that reference. Why I'm with Bob Saget.
That might be up there with a name like Smuckers, but at least that was the Today Show. So that was at least national. All right, let's get to some news. A huge case at the Supreme Court about social media and government censorship. To the Middle East, where the humanitarian crisis in Gaza continues to get worse. The UN says famine is imminent. Meanwhile, Israel killed Hamas's number three, the most senior Hamas official killed since the start of the war. And closer to home, U.S. Border Patrol says it stopped a Lebanese man claiming to be a Hezbollah bomb maker at the southern border. In tech news, Apple is in talks to let Google's Gemini power its iPhone AI features.
This is a very big deal if it happens, Jill, for tens of millions of Americans and anyone with an iPhone around the world.
To Haiti, where nearly 1,000 Americans are pleading for help as gangs unleash even more attacks. United Airlines CEO trying to reassure passengers that the airline is safe, despite a slew of safety incidents involving its planes. And welcome to the post-pandemic world. Marriage rates are up and divorce rates are down. What's behind the trend? And Moshe is on this day in history.
Jill, just about a half century apart today, we saw the debut of both a musician that you may have heard of named Bob Dylan and another one named Justin Bieber.
Okay, let's start with this major Supreme Court case about social media and accusations of government censorship. The Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday about whether there should be limits on how the government communicates with and makes requests of big tech when it comes to social media content. The Republican-led lawsuit accuses the Biden administration of violating the First Amendment by operating what they feel is a, quote, censorship enterprise to influence platforms like Twitter and Facebook to modify or take down posts. However, based on their questions Monday, it appears that a majority of the justices will reject that effort to put major limits on government requests for removal of misinformation and harmful content from tech platforms. A majority of the conservative and liberal justices expressed concern yesterday about hamstringing White House officials and other federal employees from communicating with tech giants about posts related to public health, national security, and elections that the government deems problematic. Now, this case involves a lawsuit that was initiated by two Republican-led states, Missouri and Louisiana, and individual social media users. Justice Elena Kagan, a liberal, and Brett Kavanaugh, a conservative, both suggested that such exchanges were routine occurrences and did not amount to government censorship or coercion in violation of the constitutional right to free speech. The case gives the Supreme Court an opportunity to shape how government officials interact with social media companies and communicate with the public online at a time when such platforms play an increasingly important role in elections and public debate. The justices are being asked to clarify when government attempts to combat misinformation crosses the line from permissible persuasion to unconstitutional coercion.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, think about most laws or most rulings the Supreme Court does on this pendulum. What is okay? What isn't okay? And what the Supreme Court often does is draw a line. So on the spectrum of how much pressure can the government put on a company where it crosses the line from persuasion to coercion is really at issue here for the court. So this case is called Murphy versus Missouri. Several justices suggested that the states and individuals behind the lawsuit, by the way, also didn't have sufficient grounds to sue the Biden administration. One thing you have to present at the court is that you're hurt by this, that this has done damage to you. And that was an issue that came up during the arguments yesterday as well. Several of the justices saying these individuals could not show a direct link between the government putting pressure on companies like Meta and Twitter and actual harm that was done to individuals. The attorneys general from Missouri and Louisiana tried to argue that the federal government went way too far in coercing social media companies to suppress and censor free speech of individual users, becoming deeply involved, they say, in these tech companies' decisions on whether to remove certain content. They believe that it was badgering and that it was bullying. The government, on the other hand, argued that no, the bully pulpit has always been something the government does. They should feel free and should have continued to have the ability to call media organizations, to call social media, and make requests. Certainly, Jill, as a journalist, I've gotten my fair share of calls from government officials over the years saying, you guys are making the biggest mistake ever if you run this story. You can't run this story. To the point where, like, if you run this story, soldiers will die, right? The leak that you guys had. So ultimately here, part of the debate is taking the arguments that the government has done for years for traditional media and taking them to social media and trying to draw a line here. Part of the case that the states made here included a slew of email messages between Biden officials and these tech companies. One of the points they made here is that there's a number of former U.S. government officials who now work for the tech companies. Now, that's not altogether different from the revolving door you see between the government and finance, the government and pharma. At the same time, they've reinforced here that First Amendment rights are trampled on because there was coordination here or communication between the former officials who now work at tech and the existing officials. The lower courts here actually ruled with the states, saying that the government, the feds, did go too far. You see now the Supreme Court saying, well, not so fast. We actually think there's a certain level of conversation that can happen here between the federal government and the tech companies when it comes to making suggestions as to materials that should not be on social media. One interesting thing we should add here is that both sides do this. While this case is really about the Biden administration and the fact that they were at issue here, their communications, this is something that goes back to the Trump administration, the Obama administration, Ted Cruz, individual senators, who've all made cases, and there's communication and messages to back this up, to social media to take down certain things. The practice actually has become so routine, it has a nickname, jawboning. And the tech companies have responded by establishing internal systems and individuals that ensure that influential users, including those in the government, do receive prompt responses. But the decision at the end of the day comes down to the tech companies. The bottom line here, it appears the direction the Supreme Court is going here appears to be here that the government can do whatever it wants. It can make these requests. The First Amendment prevents the government from censoring speech and punishing people for expressing different views. But companies, private companies, can do whatever they want. And so it appears here the court is ready to draw a line between what the government can tell social media companies, and they seem to have a lot of leeway here as long as it's not coercion, and that ultimately it's left to these social media companies to do whatever they want.
And it comes as the court is hearing multiple social media cases of late. On Friday, a unanimous Supreme Court ruled that public officials can sometimes be sued for blocking their critics on social media. It is an issue that first arose for the high court in a case involving then-President Donald Trump. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, writing for the court in this case, said officials who use personal accounts to make official statements may not be free to delete comments about those statements or block critics altogether. On the other hand, Barrett wrote that state officials also have private lives and their own constitutional rights. The court ruled in two cases involving lawsuits by people who were blocked after leaving critical comments on social media accounts belonging to school board members in California and a city manager in Michigan.
And then there's the other case we told you about. This involves laws passed in Florida and Texas that prohibit social media companies from taking down posts because of the views they express. We told you about it on some recent podcasts. It appears the court was critical of those laws because they're very vague. The tech companies said the laws violate their First Amendment rights to do what they want on their platform. At the same time, Republicans in those states argued that the platforms are disproportionately censoring conservative viewpoints. Again, at issue here is that the First Amendment applies to the government, but does not apply to individual social media companies. But Republicans here are arguing that these social media companies are so commonplace, so large, that they have a larger responsibility. So a lot of these key issues, Jill, now that we're about 20 years into social media, Facebook, give or take, is about 20, 21 years old, from Zuckerberg's dorm room to now, you know, a worldwide entity, multiple worldwide entities, to the court here interpreting how the Constitution applies to platforms like this. All right, we have a lot more news to get to in today's speed read, but first we want to thank one of our newest sponsors, Factor Meals. If you're pressed for time in your house, you are like many households, but you still want to eat healthy, you still want to eat nutritious. So that's why we're very excited to be partnering with Factor. They are America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service. They offer dozens of meals for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat, delivered straight to your door. They are never frozen. They go straight in the fridge and then are available for a number of days. No chopping, no prepping, no cleanup, no grocery store. The meals come straight to your door and are both delicious and offer you the nutritional quality that you deserve and the one that you're looking for. They offer about three dozen weekly meals, flexible to your schedule. You can get as much or as little as you need, choosing anywhere from 6 to 18 meals a week. You can pause or reschedule the deliveries at any time. It also includes juices, shakes, smoothies. Again, 2 minutes or less, ready to go here. You can head over to factormeals.com/monews50. That is Factor, F-A-C-T-O-R, meals.com/monews50. Why? Because you're going to get 50% off. So give it a try. Let us know what you think.
Okay, and now to one of our longtime sponsors, AG1. We're always talking on this podcast about health trends and food trends and how hard it is to just get all of your nutrients. Well, one way to get all of the important ones is Athletic Greens AG1 powder. I drink AG1 in the morning. It is one scoop with a glass of water. It is easy and quick. and it lets you get on with your day knowing that you've gotten over 75 important ingredients, including tons of vitamins and minerals. It also has pre and probiotics to support digestion and gut health. One of my friends likes to call it his insurance policy. It's like his nutritional insurance policy. He drinks it in the morning and then doesn't worry about what else he eats for the rest of the day, for the most part. So with your first purchase of AG1, Athletic Greens is giving Monews listeners a free one-year supply of their vitamin D and five free travel packs of AG1. Visit drinkag1.com/monews to take advantage of this offer. You can get a discounted monthly subscription or try it one time for just a month. Again, that is drinkag1.com/monews, M-O-N-E-W-S, for this special deal and really start to take ownership of your health. All right, let's go now to our speed read. But I quickly want to mention, if you are watching this on YouTube, you will notice that I have moved locations. I am now currently down the street at my brother-in-law and sister-in-law's house because I was having a bit of an internet issue that Mosh was very kind in bearing with me, very patient.
We've now recorded this podcast in officially four locations this evening, Jill. But the internet is looking speedy where you're at right now.
This may have to be our new internet home. I'm going to have to bring my Mo News stickers, my bookshelves, a couple of Miamis.
Or you could come to the office, Jill. You could come back to the office.
Well, we know that's not going to happen.
Too far, too much traffic. Anyway, let's do
that is a bridge too far, literally. All right, again, let's get to the speed read. Starting with the Middle East, this story from the New York Times. Experts are projecting that the northern part of Gaza could face famine conditions as soon as next month if the aid situation does not improve, and that half of the territory's population will suffer deadly levels of hunger. This is according to a new report from the global authority that has classified food security crises for decades. The report, released Monday by international relief groups, projected that famine is, quote, imminent for the 300,000 Palestinian civilians in northern Gaza. And by mid-July, as many as 1.1 million people in Gaza could face what the group characterized as the worst stage of hunger, an extreme lack of food, and severe levels of starvation, death, destitution, and acute malnutrition. That is, if conditions don't improve. Now, they have several thresholds for what defines a famine. One has already been triggered, and they fear that two others could be soon approaching.
Yeah, these projections are based on an Israeli invasion of Rafah and the worst case scenario here. It comes as airdrops from the U.S. as well as that maritime, that sea route corridor that they've opened up. Aid is starting to flow through there, but aid groups say that it's essential that the Israelis open up more land routes here and ease restrictions in order to get sufficient aid to Gazans. Israeli authorities are taking issue with the report. They're saying they place no limits on the entry of aid. They accuse the UN of failing to distribute, of being slow to distribute things in a timely manner, as well as Hamas and other gangs inside Gaza hijacking and stealing shipments of aid. Now, aid groups say that distribution is impossible in much of Gaza, specifically that northern portion that they're particularly worried about because of the ongoing warfare, the difficulty of coordinating with the Israeli military, the overall breakdown of law and order. You may have been seeing videos circulating recently of trucks being hijacked by Hamas and other groups, as well as videos from markets in southern Gaza and Rafah full of food, but at sky-high prices, exorbitant prices, allegedly there. That's the case where people are stealing food and then reselling it at high prices. So just a breakdown of order there in Gaza. The big issue, though, is that, of course, a lot of civilians are suffering here. So that's a story we're continuing to monitor. In other news, Marwan Issa, the deputy commander of Hamas's military wing, basically known as the number three top senior leader in Gaza, is officially been pronounced dead here. Hamas now acknowledges that after an airstrike earlier this month. The Israelis and Hamas both suspected this, but this has been confirmed in the last 24 hours, including by U.S. officials. U.S. saying the rest of the top Hamas leaders are in hiding, likely deep in the tunnel network, and justice will come for them as well. Issa is the most senior person believed to have been killed so far in the fighting on the Hamas end. He was seen as playing a critical role for Hamas, including developing plans and coordinating those October 7th terror attacks. Jill, one more item here as we leave the Middle East. There's still a lot of coordination happening in the back end between the Israelis and the Americans, despite some of the choice words that have been exchanged in recent days between Biden and Netanyahu, between Chuck Schumer and Netanyahu. There was a phone call yesterday, one of the first ones in several weeks now, between President Biden and the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, And apparently in that call, according to the White House, Biden warned him against invading Rafah, that is the southernmost city in Gaza, where about a quarter of Hamas leadership remains right now, but also where 1.5 million civilians are currently displaced. The Americans are very concerned about a civilian catastrophe should the Israelis invade there. They've now invited top Israeli military officials to come to the White House to talk about plans around Rafah in the coming weeks. And it looks like they have taken up that invitation. So still a lot of moving parts there, Jill. And it comes as late Monday, we learned that ceasefire talks are the closest that they've been in a while since a Hamas counteroffer late last week. So we're going to watch what comes of that, what that means to the hostages, and a potential short-term or long-term ceasefire.
Meanwhile, a bit closer to home, this from NBC News. Border Patrol agents stopped a Lebanese migrant at the border near El Paso, Texas, earlier this month, who claimed to be a member of Hezbollah. A Customs and Border Protection official saying that he told agents that he was going to New York and was going to try to make a bomb.
Remarkable honesty from this guy, Jill.
Yeah, I mean, that is the only part of the story that makes you kind of scratch your head and think, what? You know, is that something that he would be admitting? what is your purpose here in the United States?
To make a bomb. Yeah, so we appreciate this man's honesty.
The man, he is now in U.S. custody. There is an active investigation into him and his claims. His name is Basil Abadi. He is 22 years old, and he had been apprehended trying to cross the border in Texas on March 9th.
Yeah, so Hezbollah, you know, we're familiar with them given their power and the ongoing small-scale war they have going on with the Israelis on the Lebanese-Israeli border right now. They have been deemed decades ago a foreign terrorist organization going back to the 80s. And NBC has been reporting, going back to the fall, that border agents have been concerned by a growing number of individuals on the FBI's terror watch list who've been trying to enter the country as we've seen the surge of migrants across the border. It's not known whether this guy, who again admitted he was coming to the U.S. to build a bomb, was on this terror watch list. Jill, it does come as we got some breaking news late Monday from the Supreme Court, just dealing with the border. They extended a block on Texas's new law, their immigration law, that is being challenged right now by the Biden administration. Remember, we've been covering this fight between Texas and the U.S. government. Texas passed its own law saying, we can handle immigration law ourselves and deport people ourselves. The federal government saying, nope, that's the federal government. Every state does not get to have its own immigration law. Well, that is being adjudicated in the lower courts, and they don't want, the feds don't want this law to go into effect. And it looks like Justice Alito, who oversees the circuit that includes Texas, agrees with them, at least agrees to put a freeze on that law right now. So the Supreme Court officially saying that this law cannot go into effect while lower courts deal with whether Texas has the authority to make this law. So this ruling now blocked indefinitely after several short-term blocks. It gives the Supreme Court more time to determine what to do next as the law in question, it's called SB4, continues to be debated now in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
All right, some tech news from Bloomberg. A blockbuster deal looks to be in the works that will bring AI to your phone and shake up the industry. Apple's in talks to build Google's Gemini artificial intelligence engine into the iPhone. The two companies are in active negotiations to let Apple license Gemini, Google's set of generative AI models, to power some new features coming to the iPhone software this year. Apple also recently held discussions with competitor OpenAI and has considered using its model. Microsoft is the big backer behind OpenAI and its ChatGPT platform. Back to those Google talks, though, if a deal between Apple and Google does happen, it would build upon the two companies' search partnership. For years, Google has paid Apple billions of dollars to make its search engine the default option in the Safari web browser on the iPhone and other devices.
Yeah, you often don't think about that stuff, but when you get an iPhone and you search for stuff in Safari, Google is paying a lot of money for Google to be your search engine there. So now they're looking at a larger arrangement here, and it led both stocks to rally yesterday. Apple, for its part, has been working on its own AI models to debut with iOS 18, but it appears that the fact that they're looking for a partner here signals that Apple's AI ain't ready for prime time. Google's Gemini might sound familiar to you because recently we told you about it. That's the one that had its historically inaccurate image fiasco a couple of weeks ago. Jill, remember the Nazi-era German soldiers that were Asian women and George Washington being black? Basically, overcorrection for political correctness on the part of the programmers. So Google says it's looking to fix it quickly. Now it's negotiating with Apple. As far as how this would work, think about it like Siri on crack. As opposed to dictating a specific message, AI works by saying something as simple as write an apology note to my wife, or respond to my friend in a funny way after their tough day, or create a meme about the royal family, all in your text message. So it'll enable, you know, that functionality over time. And so Gemini, or if Apple goes with the competitor ChatGPT, would create images or generate text from short prompts into your phone. At the same time, I'm sure there will be major regulatory pushback here. Just to give you a sense of things, we're talking about three of the top five largest companies in the world. Apple is worth $2.6 trillion. Google and its parent company, Alphabet, worth $1.7 trillion. And if Apple goes with ChatGPT, effectively run by Microsoft, Microsoft is a $3 trillion company, the largest in the world. So anytime these companies are talking about working together, you can be sure that folks in Washington are wondering whether that's a good thing for consumers.
It is interesting, though, because one of the rumored reasons that Apple was pulling back from the Apple iCar Project Titan was that it was going to put more resources into generative AI. So the fact that it's perhaps ceding this now to a different company, Google, or even ChatGPT, tells you that they're not really where they want to be. Apple would, of course, want to own this technology themselves.
Yeah. And by the way, it could be a short-term arrangement until Apple's is ready to go, but Apple sees where the marketplace is going and wants to remain competitive, and working with a partner right now appears to be it. Now, again, this is very preliminary, but still very interesting reporting.
From Fox News, the State Department revealed Monday that nearly 1,000 Americans have filled out a crisis intake form seeking assistance in Haiti, a country it is now calling one of the most dire humanitarian situations in the world. A State Department spokesperson made the remark hours after dozens of Americans landed in Miami on a U.S. government chartered evacuation flight from Haiti. Reports are emerging of gangs killing at least 12 people early Monday morning in a suburb of Port-au-Prince following the looting of homes in two upscale neighborhoods. As for when the 1,000 or so Americans might be able to get out, the State Department saying it's monitoring the situation closely and evaluating the demand of U.S. citizens, the overall security situation, and what is feasible when it comes to commercial transportation options and other transportation solutions. Remember, these gangs have pretty much blocked the airport.
Yeah, they control much of the capital there. And despite the fact that they said that things would stabilize after the prime minister agreed to resign, which happened last week, they appear to continue to be choking off the food supply, fuel supply, water across the capital and in some other parts of the country. Remember, Ariel Henry has agreed to resign, but he hasn't resigned officially yet. He's waiting for a transitional government. So it appears the gangs continue to wreak havoc and create chaos around the country right now. At the same time, now you have some Haitians organizing themselves in a vigilante movement against the gangs. This anti-gang movement has been seen in communities from neighborhood defense committees, shared fortifications, surveillance systems, checkpoints, their own patrols. And this is seen as necessary because the police completely ineffective, the army non-existent. But what this could mean is this could unfold here, sadly, into civil war, mob justice. And that's extremely concerning to folks on the ground there, as well as folks watching here in the U.S. and around the world.
From Yahoo News, the CEO of United Airlines on Monday attempted to reassure members of the flying public after the carrier was involved in multiple highly publicized safety incidents earlier this month. The CEO, Scott Kirby, saying, quote, safety is our highest priority and is at the center of everything we do. Unfortunately, in the past few weeks, our airline has experienced a number of incidents that are reminders of the importance of safety. His email comes after pilots on one of the airline's flights earlier this week discovered a missing external panel on the underside of their Boeing 737 after landing in Oregon on a flight from San Francisco with 139 passengers and six crew members aboard. So they were just doing kind of like a post-flight check and realized that a key piece of the plane was missing.
And it comes as the FAA is investigating a separate incident after a wheel fell earlier this month from a United Airlines 777 that was headed from San Francisco to Japan. There was a separate incident recently at Bush Airport in Houston where a United jet, a 737 MAX, rolled off the runway. Notably, all of these incidents unrelated. Some are pilot error, some maintenance issues, some related to the manufacturer Boeing. But so United here is reinforcing that and trying to reassure the public that the third largest airline in the country is taking these issues seriously, because again, they hit different areas. The United CEO urging employees to come forward if they see something or have any safety concerns. This has always been a really important thing, and is one of the reasons why flying is the safest way to get around the country, is they have created systems here in the aftermath of accidents in the 70s and 80s, where we used to see much more in the way of accidents, enabling employees without fear of losing their jobs to come forward with any safety issues. So United reinforcing that to employees here. Meanwhile, the FAA is continuing to look into Boeing, has called on them to develop a comprehensive plan to deal with quality control issues there. And that's after a string of issues separate from United. That's Boeing, the manufacturer of planes for United and other airlines.
From CNN, marriage rates are up and divorce rates are down, according to new data from the CDC. After COVID-19 lockdowns, 2022 was a year of marriages. The number of marriages took a dive around the start of the pandemic, not too surprising. For the past two decades, the number of marriages stayed at around 7 to 8 per 1,000 people a year. But in 2020, the marriage rate was down to 5.1 per 1,000 people. The rate did start to climb the next year. And by 2022, the number of marriages had reached 6.2 per capita and over 2 million in a year, according to the report. Being married was also associated with significantly higher reports of happiness. One family therapist telling CNN that growth in marriage rates may be because more than just rescheduling of marriages that were postponed. She says being in a lockdown together gave many couples a unique hurdle to overcome, one that made them get intentional about how they approached important things like finances, compromise, and autonomy.
Definitely heard a variety of stories, Jill, about how COVID impacted various relationships. But we'll say anecdotally, we got married in the summer of 2021, coming out of the pandemic. So doing our little part here, Jill, to contribute to the increasing rates.
Thank you, Motion Alex.
Yeah, we're taking this one by one here. Meanwhile, according to the CNN story, divorce rates are also going down in 2022. The divorce rate was 2.4 per 1,000 people. That isn't the lowest it's ever been. That was 2021 when it was 2.3, but it does continue a downward trend. It's nearly half. The divorce rate is nearly half what it was in the year 2000, 20 years ago. It is notable because people are getting married a little later in life these days. So that could certainly be one of the factors here in a lowering divorce rate. Again, depending on the therapist they spoke to in the CNN story, they believe that, again, COVID was a factor here in actually getting people to work through various issues, though this looks like a larger systemic trend here over the last couple decades.
It is funny because anecdotally, at least the people that I know either got married, like you and Alex, or got divorced, or broke up and realized, like, I cannot with this person.
There were basically two ways you could go coming out of pandemic. All right, that brings us to On This Day in History. On this March 19th, we're going to begin in the year 1931. Happy 93rd birthday to gambling in Vegas. On this day in history, Nevada legalized gambling. And Vegas was still a pretty small little Western town at the time, Jill. It was when Cuba went communist, because Havana was a real gambling mecca for a long time there, that in the 60s is really when Vegas took off. All right, fast forward to 1995 with a fax that simply said, "I'm back." Michael Jordan returned to professional basketball on this day in 1995, where he would go on to win three more NBA championships. Jill, I love that factoid because it just gives you a sense of where the world was technologically back then. Because today he probably would have tweeted that or done something on social media. In 1995, his agency literally had to fax just his statement, which was, "I'm back, Michael Jordan."
Mosh, the next time I have a big professional announcement, I'm faxing it to the Mo News office.
Do you still have a fax machine?
My parents do.
At your Long Island headquarters? Of course they do. Okay. Tell them to, honestly, based on the internet lately, Jill, you might have to fax in your podcast.
I'm not sure how it's going to work, but I'm going to look into it.
But we'll look into the fax machine and what it's capable of. Okay, fast forward here to 2003. On this day, George W. Bush ordered airstrikes on Baghdad, launching the second Iraq war, this one to oust Saddam Hussein. And Jill, remarkably, 21 years later, we still have U.S. troops in Iraq. And we end here with a bit of music history. On this day in 1957, for $102,000, Elvis Presley bought Graceland. Today, you can still visit it. It's been preserved precisely the way he left it when he passed away in Graceland back in 1977. All right, and two music debuts on this day. We're going to begin in 1962. little guy named Bob Dylan released his self-titled debut album to mixed reviews. At the time, Billboard magazine wrote, "Dylan, when he finds his own style, he could win a big following."
That Robert Zimmerman mosh.
Jill only refers to artists and Hollywood actors by their original birth names.
So really quickly, one of my former producers, the same one if you were listening yesterday, who strongly believes that Kelly Rowland should have been the breakout star from Destiny's Child.
This anonymous person is getting a lot of airtime on this podcast lately.
Her trick for getting celebrities to answer questions whenever there's a lot of reporters around or big crowds is to call them by their original given names, not their stage names. So she told me about Sting, who she once wanted to get a question from. Instead of yelling Sting, she's like, "Gordon, Gordon," because I guess that's his actual name. And sure enough, he turned around.
There you go. Jill, we'll end here with one more debut. This one in 2010 by a young man named Justin Bieber. He turned 16 years old just 3 weeks before this debut, My World 2.0, with his hit, Baby. The album hits number one, and the rest is history.
Mosh, what's your favorite Justin Bieber song?
Jill, it changes, but I feel like I get my peaches down in Georgia. I'm going to go with Peaches.
That's a great one. What's the song that's, "My mama don't like you and she likes everyone"?
Jill, that's Love Yourself.
Great song.
Listen, that Bieber.
he's got something.
He's had a few hits. He's got something.
He's going places.
He really has a future. He's going places. I think he sold his collection of music for like $400 or $500 million recently.
At the age of 29.
Yeah, he turned 30 years old earlier this month on March 1st. Talk about 30 under 30, Jill.
I was going to say, he's not going to make my 60 over 60 list.
Listen, given how prolific he is, he might do it.
He
might do some more. Yeah.
All right, everyone, thank you for bearing with us on this multi-location episode of the Mo News Podcast. If you like what you hear, share this with your friends. It will help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and review us in the App Store. And one of the things, if you're listening or watching, that you would notice besides my different location is doing this podcast late at night, Mosh definitely talks a little bit quieter because the baby is sleeping.
Yes. Yeah, so if I sounded a little quieter for the back half of this podcast, it has to do with the fact that I'm about 10 feet away from a sleeping baby. So I'm trying not to disturb her. A reminder, just as you finish this podcast, go give Mo News the Interview a follow and make sure you're following now our second podcast. Jill, we've doubled the amount of podcasts we now do here at Mo News.
I do want to mention on that interview feed, your interview with Vlad Duthier about Haiti was awesome. I listened to it today and I learned so much about the history of the country. And listening to you and Vlad, it's like the two of you guys are encyclopedias.
Both I was joking of you. With Vlad. I go, "Vlad, we need to do separate episodes where we just go into the history of various subjects," because it was a fascinating 300-year journey just through Caribbean and Haitian history. And we didn't even get to the half of it. So definitely give it a listen. We gave it to the premium feed last week, but it got such incredible reviews. And so many of you are interested in learning more about Haiti. We're making it available to everybody on Mo News, The Interview.
All right, everyone. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News Podcast.